Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle, coming up on the programme this week.
Obviously, your podcast is about conversation around mental health. That conversation will lead people to meaningful actions, and that's what's important.
We look for grand things and we look for grand gestures. And I think sometimes we forget the little things, the looking into yourself, the small steps that you can take that make those small differences.
And actually, just the act of drawing, just sitting down and drawing is a wonderful therapeutic way of almost dumping what we've done in the world on a piece of paper.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday.
The home of the UK's conversation about mental health. Welcome to the podcast. My name's Mick Coyle. I've got some great news for you just before we crack on with this week's episode, and it's in regard to our Iron Men project, which we got involved in ahead of World Suicide Prevention Day at the end of August, start of September last year. We've had two nominations at the Commercial Radio News Awards, and actually I think it's the second and third nominations overall for the project so far. That's really, really fantastic news. Best news coverage for World Suicide Prevention Day through the Iron Men project, where we gather guys on the Crosby Beach to stand alongside Anthony Gormley's Iron Men statue. If you've not listened to that episode, I would urge you to check it out. If you type my name into Twitter and type in Iron Men, you can see the video as well of what we did there. So best news coverage, but also best news feature or campaign as well. Such a wide campaign, isn't it, that we have here at Mental Health Monday to encourage people to talk about their mental health, but also to bring down those suicide numbers. So the Commercial Radio News Awards, two nominations we received for the Iron Men Project, which I think is, I don't know if it's unprecedented, it certainly feels like it, to have two nominations across different categories in such a prestigious awards. Yeah, absolutely delighted, really, really pleased, and thank you so much to everybody who took place from, I can't name everybody, there's so many people and so many different organisations, but absolutely First Person Project, the Proper Mental Podcast, Jake Mills Chasing the Stigma, Life Rooms Project, Martin Gallier Project, Lily and the team at Lee Cooper Foundation. There are so many different organizations. Mind Map, Love Art Global. Oh, it was absolutely fantastic, and it's been recognized as well. So again, not for the first time as well. So really pleased with that one. Do check out that World Suicide Prevention Day Iron Men special, because, yeah, I hope you'll agree, it was a really special, special occasion. I've got details and a competition, actually, that you might want to enter. Often we've talked on the programme about finding various different ways of finding your way into exploring your mental health. And some people will do that through running or gardening or knitting, crochet. People will do that through painting and sculpting and all kinds of different five-a-side football. It's all out there. There's a competition, actually, though, for people who are involved in the art world. It can be all kind of different aspects of the art world. You might know more than me some of the things that are available, from dance, painting, pottery might be included in that one as well. Might be a bit of written word, spoken word in there as well. But there is a UK-wide competition that's been launched celebrating creative works covering mental health and well-being, organised by the team at Zealous. And I'll get a link to the competition in the podcast write-up. We've got a brilliant guest, though, who's the CEO of Zealous, Guy Armitage. He's originally Swiss, which is where the name Guy comes from. And this is a really wide-ranging conversation, to be honest. There's a lot in there about what the competition is about, but also about our place as human beings within the world and the planet and the people around us. There's a lot, I think, of probably philosophy as much as anything in this conversation, as well as Guy's own story, which he was really open and honest about. And coming originally from Switzerland, there's a specific angle in that as well, which we'll touch on as part of the conversation. But this is a really interesting episode, which I hope you're really going to enjoy. Great to spend a little bit of time with Guy. He really sort of sees the world in a way which I think is really sort of intelligent, but reflective of his own career and his own sort of expertise. He's originally working in AI, so of course as part of that has to think about how a robot or how a piece of machinery could make decisions. And it's interesting, later in the conversation he talks about how he sort of explored his own decision making processes to try and think about how that decision making actually happens and why it happens within our brains. So on to our guest, Guy Armitage, CEO of Zealous. We started off the conversation by looking at the, maybe the idea that the world feels like it's going in two maybe different directions at the moment. One where we embrace some of the challenges and we come up with really collective solutions, and together we can tackle a lot of the issues that we're dealing with through community, through big political decisions, and the environmental change and everything that comes in between, versus another way the world feels like it's going with the rise of the far right, insular looking nations, you know, massive myths, truths, lies being told in the media by very, very senior figures. And, you know, you can despair at that as well. But I put it to Guy that maybe one hand positive, the other hand negative, maybe we're something like closer to looking at a future which is somewhere in the middle.
I suspect that's just the amount of news that we get now. So before we were blissfully unaware of what was happening in the world, and we had the problems that were closer to us. Now it feels like we're aware of all of the problems, the things that might impact us directly and not. And it is overpowering and overwhelming. So you have this massive contrast of the ebbs and flows of, hey, there's something amazing, jubilations, and go out in the street and celebrate something that's happened. And then the next day, suddenly price of living, inflation. It is a challenging time, and things are moving very quickly. But also challenging times are times of opportunity to change our society and to develop it into perhaps a more empathetic model, something that suits us as humans, as opposed to the machines that we were when we were in the Victorian era, that's kind of pushed itself into this century, kicking and screaming, maybe.
I think one of the differences as well, certainly in the modern era, is that as the world changes and we have knowledge of that change, it's kind of asking questions of us, even if it's indirectly. It's kind of saying to us, well, what do you think of this? Does this sound right to you? And I think in the past, major change, let's say the Industrial Revolution, you know, people who were just caught up in that, hey, guess what? There's an opportunity now because we've got this factory and you're going to create cotton products for X, Y, or Z. People didn't have a say in that, but it feels like now, like the world interacts with us a little bit more. Well, equally, it's equally the case that we also can feel completely powerless despite that perceived interaction.
I feel that perhaps we're like everything, we go in extremes, right? So we didn't have a say, and now maybe we have so much of a say that we have little action. So we have these moments where people want to be involved in something, and the easiest way of them doing it is to post something and to talk about it and to express themselves. It's not always sort of followed up by actions, something that will actually meaningfully make a difference in their lives. And it's a fine balance between the two. It's amazing to have your say, but it's also overwhelming to hear everyone have their say. Some people say things we don't want to hear. Some people say things that completely throw us into kind of an alien world that we don't understand. And also, sometimes we just happen to be in the wrong room, really. Because a lot of people will be saying something in one room, but another room will be saying something completely different. And I think the issue we've had with social media is these echo chambers that have been created around us. So we say something and then suddenly we're surrounded by either our opinion or the absolute contradiction to it. But we never really have that lovely gray area, which is actually probably 90% of the population. So we do think that we're in a more extreme world, but actually it's only a simulated extremism.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I think the other thing is that sometimes people, you can almost get a sense that you are playing a part through a social media post, thinking that that's going to make a real difference. Whereas at the same time, the old-fashioned ways of lobbying politicians, writing letters, being in people's faces about particular issues, being a proactive, if you chaining yourself to something if you want it to be protected, or you know, all of those things are the traditional ways of making a difference. And I think sometimes people, like, they'll call themselves an activist now because they like and retweet posts on Facebook, but that only feeds into that world that kind of already exists. And I wonder whether or not the idea of real change is much more profound and actually has a much more historic context. If things need to get done, they need to get done in a certain way. And it's a one in a million shot that one post that you put on social media will change the world. It's much more about a grassroots movement of people doing a lot of small things, but doing it together.
Absolutely. I think it's good to be able to express ourselves. Being able to express yourself is very important. But if you are going to spend 20 seconds on writing a tweet or 20 seconds recycling things that you might not recycle, that the recycling is going to have a bigger impact on the planet than you tweeting, by the way, the environment's really important. Most people would agree with that. But actually, is there a meaningful action behind that? Also, there's this kind of hidden cost that behind technology that people perhaps don't look at, which is sending that tweet is actually going to cost CO2. You're going to be creating pollution around it. And I've seen some really interesting projects where they want to really have an impact on the environment. And I think it was an art kind of tombola where they would sell NFT art. And when you look into NFT and you realize how polluting it is to use NFTs, and then you balance that with the purpose of the competition of raising funding to protect the environment, you have to start thinking, well, is it just offsetting its own footprint, or is it actually having a creative, meaningful change towards the planet? But conversation is what starts it, and then action is what follows it. And I think we have the conversation now. It would be lovely to have the action.
Absolutely.
And obviously your podcast is about conversation around mental health. That conversation will lead people to meaningful actions. And that's what's important. It's having that ability to have a dialogue and that openness to potentially sharing things that we're not comfortable with, or we feel we're kind of outside our zone, and we might be taking risks, but that's it's important. It's interesting.
Absolutely. And actually, let's be absolutely honest, the mental health world is full of the equivalent of the NFT tombola there. People saying, be kind, look after yourself. And then they're not kind themselves. They don't look after themselves, and they don't look after the people around them, but they grandstand, they well-being wash across their channels and social media posts, that they think that this is something really important. And yet that grassroots steps that they should be taking on that never materializes, because they see it as a fashionable badge to wear, as opposed to, and this will be part of our conversation today, the fact that our mental health is part of absolutely everything, you know, and our sense of our place in the world, how we respond to the world, how the world responds to us. And that's absolutely huge. We'll come on to talk about the competition you've got coming up as well from an artistic point of view. But I think we're in a place now where people, I think, feel as if they want to make a difference, but you often don't know what that difference will be or how that difference will come about. And we look for grand things and we look for grand gestures. And I think sometimes we forget the little things, the looking into yourself, the small steps that you can take that make those small differences that eventually lead on to much bigger things down the line. And I think that journey is one to be sort of embraced and explored, that we can take those steps forward and actually then take three steps back and go, okay, well, that wasn't really working for me. Or take a couple of steps forward, looking at a bit of self-care that you're doing, or a new project or a new hobby that you want to engage with, knowing that it might lead to something. But even if it doesn't lead to anything, just the process of taking that journey will be beneficial to you. We've got to test out those little pathways, haven't we, to find out what they are.
Absolutely. And I feel like there's two things, really. There's what you output to the world, and there's how you feel internally, really. And you can only really help the world around you if you feel like you're balanced and you've got something to give. And that's something that I've learned over time. It's sometimes I was too kind and I would give too much of myself to the point where it would be detrimental to my own well-being. And that balance is quite difficult. I have two young kids, so it's take, take, take. And then you realize that I almost feel like it's like a phone, right? I have a battery and I'm out of juice, and then I have to go and take a step back and get that energy back. But in terms of little actions that you can undertake, even if you are running out of energy, something as simple as a smile. I've had meaningful moments. I mean, I'm based in London. We're famous for not interacting with each other and trying to put our head down and not speak to each other. But just smiling to someone who seems to be either having a bad day or is trying to you can see that they want to engage with you. It's something as small as that could create something inside them that would just fill up their battery a little bit. It doesn't take much, but an exploration, definitely. It's seeing what's available to you. And that, I guess there's so much to cover in this question. It's really hard because there is a lot about resourcing yourself, and there's a lot about how you can allow people to express themselves and resource others. But obviously, you know, I'm trying to balance it out. I guess art is a wonderful way of doing that. And I see art as kind of an interface between people and a way of communicating where perhaps words would fail us. And exploring art and the act of creating something, the act of making something. As children, it's something that's so inbuilt. We want to make a drawing. We want to go and show our guardians and parents what we're doing. We're very proud of making something. And as we grow older, we're not good enough. We make excuses. We're not artists because we're not. And actually, just the act of drawing, just sitting down and drawing is a wonderful therapeutic way of almost dumping what we've done in the world on a piece of paper. And it could be anything. It could be movement. It's anything that you as an individual feel comfortable with. I mean, people screaming underneath bridges because there's so much pressure, they feel a lot better when the train goes out. You see in films, they go, and the train goes by. That level of expression that we've almost, we've controlled ourselves so much. We can't do that anymore, but the arts allow us to have that space where we can experiment and learn and empty these emotions on paper and perhaps share these emotions with people in ways that we didn't think we could.
And I think that the idea of expressing your emotions feels like a modern thing, yet quite clearly for centuries, art has been the thing which has allowed people, artists, to think, the thing that's in my head, I'm going to put it up on this piece of paper. And it's not the exact thing that's in my head, but it's as close to the thing that I can represent. And then you can look at it too. And then you can decide whether or not that you think the same sort of thing. And we're going to have this sort of indirect conversation through a piece or a form. And actually, that's a really sort of modern way of looking at how we can talk about our mental health, where we go, look, I can't describe it to you in words, but if I can portray it in this way, maybe you can get a sense of what I'm thinking. And at the same time, you might start to think different things based on what I'm offering as part of this artwork. And that's huge, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think it's also just, it's the understanding that what you create and what you feel about that piece is not what, for example, if I showed it to you, you will experience. You'll always template your own experiences on it. And within art and history, I think it's a bit complicated because artists in history used to capture historical moments, and it was more defined towards that. Now it's more about self-expression and being able to create something that others can experience. And experiences is a big word in the last 20, 30 years. People don't go to the theater anymore. They go to experiences. They want to feel emotions. They want to be brought somewhere. And it will always be through their own eyes, through their own experiences. And what may make one person cry will make another person laugh. And that the dialogue around that, coming out of, let's say, a film and seeing how each other felt about it, also is a very rich conversation. So the artist is able to offload some of their thoughts and how they feel about the world, but then the audience is enriched by that and able to define their own emotions around it and create talking points. And I think that's one of the big parts of what we're trying to do with a competition. It's taking things that exist, the works that exist, and these experiences that people have lived, bringing them together and creating dialogue. And we can't control the dialogue. We're not interested in that. What we're interested in is to bring it under one roof and start a conversation and see how people feel about it. And if people take it away and it's positive, or it makes them discover something new, then we've achieved what we want to do. We just want people to ask questions. And that's really important.
Yeah, let's just touch on the competition. I'll put a link to where people can enter through the Zealous website, dead straightforward. I'll put that in the link to the podcast and you supporting Create through this one. It's a UK-wide competition celebrating creative works covering mental health and well-being. It's fair to say that's a pretty open description. So what sort of things are you expecting to see in terms of your entries between now and the closing date on the 11th of July?
Well, I don't want to put anything out there too much because then I'll be defining it. We kept it open-ended for a reason. I think I have based on previous competitions. So we actually had another one, which wasn't about mental health at all. And what we realized is it was just creative writing pieces. And I think we got about 400 creative writing pieces. And what became really apparent when I was shortlisting it, and I was actually reading every single piece of writing. So that was 400 manuscripts, 10 pages long. It was a grueling experience. But I would say that 95% of the manuscripts touched on mental health and well-being in either shape or form. It could have been household violence. It was people really trying to express themselves and talk about their experiences, and sometimes directly, sometimes indirectly. But it was surprising how much of it came forward. And also that the journey I personally went through, and Ashlyn, who is our community manager, when we were reading these manuscripts after 3 days of reading that, just feeling depleted, but seeing the beauty in some of these stories alongside obviously the hard experiences that people have lived. So I'm always surprised by what people send us. And I don't know if it will be personal. I don't know if it's something that they will intellectualize. I don't know how they will look through that. But what I am interested is in how it will make people feel and how impactful it is. And whether or not we feel it will create a dialogue, or if it's very closed, and it'll be interesting to see what comes forward. I basically don't have an answer, is basically what I'm telling you, Nick.
that's right. It can be anything. And actually, as we hear that, depending on how it gets absorbed by the person reading it or viewing it or seeing it or hearing it, whatever it would be, offers us a all kinds of different insights into where it's come from. Can I ask you in terms of obviously when you perceive a piece that's about mental health or something that touches on anxiety or depression or grief or whatever it would be, that will play on your own experiences of all of those things. Can you give us a sense of what your base is, or what do you base your perceptions of mental health around?
That's a tremendously hard question, but I'll try and answer it as directly as I can. So I personally, in my life, I was always different. I went through the schooling system. I went to a boarding school. I was surrounded by 300 people, but I never fit in. And I think that potentially also I was stubborn not to want to change and trying to stay true to myself. But that obviously created dark places, because you're essentially going through a period of transformation where you're finding your identity, but you're surrounded by people that you don't relate to. And I must admit, I think in some moments in that time of my life, I may have gone through my mind simulating what the world would have looked like without me in it. And going over that a couple of times, I just taking myself away and saying, well, will the world be better? Will the world be worse? It felt like a dress rehearsal, really. It felt like me looking at future options and also my personal value. Luckily for me at that point, I guess I was anchored enough. I won't say that there was enough love around me, because I think there's always enough love around you. It's whether or not you as a person perceive it, and it allows to anchor you to where you are. So I felt that deeply personally at that moment in my life. Now, going on from that, I flourished. It became a strength. When I left the schooling system and I actually found my own way, I realized that that's what makes me, and that's what allows me to do what I do. And it's, I think the visual is, it's a bit like an orchid. You don't give it any water. It's suffering. And then suddenly you put a bit of water and it flourishes. So that's been good. But I've also, over the course of my life, felt that through, I guess everyone's like that. You have experiences which challenge you and that change your perception of it. So you talk about a journey. I feel more like I'm inside a room with a strobe light and I kind of get on with it. And then suddenly the strobe light goes on and I'm aware of mental health, and then it goes off again. And then I continue with my life. And then I've moved, because it's a bit of a weird one, but in these strobe moments, I had a great aunt that went through the assisted suicide route. I'm Swiss. That's something that happens actually more often than not in Switzerland when you get to the end of your life, when you're older. I've seen friends go through dealing with being diagnosed with being bipolar, and then the stigmas of that, and how the families responded to that. And I'm not judging, but just seeing these experiences and seeing how these stigmas have played out have made me more aware of mental health and what's there. And then I manage people. I have 16 people in my team. So I know that one in four people is struggling with mental health at the moment in the UK. If I manage 16 people, I know that four of my guys are struggling. Some will want to talk about it, some won't. But my responsibility as the owner of the business is to make sure that I support them in whichever way I can. And I do try my best, but without a clear communication, it can be quite difficult. And it can be seen as a weakness. So why would you go to your manager with a weakness? Me talking about my own mental health could be perceived by weakness by my employees. Why would they be inspired to follow me if they felt like potentially there was, if they saw mental health as a weakness? Then how can I bring them forward if I say, hey, this is a human trait that I have, but it's down to their perception, whether or not they see it as a strength or as a weakness. It's difficult. I think we're at an interesting juncture now where the conversations that you're having, the conversations that the world is having, is kind of shining a light on it and saying, you know, it's present everywhere. Everyone's going to go through it. Everyone struggles. And just being able to have that conversation might actually already alleviate it and take some of the load off. And of course, taking actions towards that, the next step, which is what we started with, that's the next thing. But there is a, it doesn't feel like a journey, Vic. It doesn't feel like I've taken this long journey towards mental health. It feels like the strobe lights have gone on, and it feels like now the light is starting to be brighter and brighter, and I'm much more aware of it in everything that I see.
So this is what I was going to ask you. And you mentioned having two children as well. I'm a dad of two young children too. And I was going to ask you, when you mentioned the strobe lights, are you finding now that the strobe is flashing up moments more so than it was when you were growing up? Because that's certainly been my experience now, where people will talk to me now about an issue that someone's had or something that's going on, or how somebody responded to something. And instantly I go, that's a mental health conversation that needs to be had there. Whereas opposed to in the past, you'd go, oof, well, I wonder what's going on there. Or here's a little bit of gossip about how somebody, you know, did X, Y, or Z in a workplace or a home environment. To me now, that strobe light is throbbing away constantly. And I can see these things at least once or twice a day. I'll go, that's a mental health, that's a well-being concern. And that's the nature of the conversation that needs to come forth. And that's why I now, and I've used this phrase a million times, and I probably used it already today, this mental health in everything, we've got to be so aware of that, because once you have a little bit of knowledge of it, you start to see both the seeds of it, but also the flowers of it in almost every aspect of your life and the lives of people around you.
It's a responsibility that you're kind of given, isn't it? You're blissfully unaware of it, and then suddenly you kind of feel, oh, okay, this is happening around me. And maybe going back to the strobe lights, I think at the beginning of my mental health journey, the strobes went off without my, this, it was something that was dropped on me. Now I feel like I'm switching on the lights. and I'm trying to see what's around me and explore what's around me. And I think it's a byproduct of growing up. It's a byproduct of the conversations that we're having in society at the moment and that openness that's being created. I've experienced some incredible pieces of art that have opened my eyes to things that I would have never experienced and potentially generated empathy with topics that potentially were out of my reach. And I think there's a couple of examples. There was this incredible theater maker called Rhiannon Fate who created a performance called Smack That. And what she did essentially is she wanted to talk about violence towards women and household violence. And she created a play, but she didn't just create a play. She brought five or six women that had that happen within their environment to help write the script and be the actors within it. And just experiencing that and seeing them relive some of those moments and open up to the world about how they felt and what was happening to them, I suspect was very hard, but also potentially very therapeutic and allowed them to have these conversations with each other about these experiences that they had. And within the arts, that is everywhere. There's another play that was incredible called Minefield, which was veterans from the Falkland Wars. But it wasn't just British. They were also Argentinian soldiers on stage together telling their stories. And some of them had lost limbs over it. And they were enemies and friends on stage. And that was fascinating. So I almost feel like that the arts create this safe space where we can almost say, I'm leaving my life and my interpretation of it out of the door. And I'm now going to go and experience it in a way that's completely different. And that's really helpful because we don't have many safe spaces anymore. We project on social media, but social media is not a great place to take in because there's so much toxicity. So where exactly do you go to kind of learn about your emotions in an indirect way? Because the other thing is, some people I find they're like, oh, I will learn about my emotions. I'm going to go out there. I'm going to really, but it takes some courage to do that. Yeah. But actually, if you can catch people unaware and you can make them feel something, that's incredible. That's world affirming and changing.
I think, and I don't know if you've had this experience, but as I've got older, I turned 40 this year, for instance, like if I have one of those moments that you have an experience or, you know, there's a moment that makes you think, I never thought about that. But now I can see my worldview on that particular issue has changed completely as a result of that experience. To me, it's made me think that life isn't about a plan for the future or how you want to be yourself. Life is this thing which is going along. And actually, it's moment by moment. And as those moments come, you absorb or you reject or you accept. And then you just move on to the next thing. And actually, our existence on the whole planet is much more based around what's coming to me and then what am I putting back out on a daily basis. It's not about what am I going to do in 10 years? What's going to happen to me? What sort of person do I want to become? It's about what is the person that I am now thinking in the environment that I am now? And how will that change over the course of the next 5, 10, 15 years and beyond? But to be aware that it's happening now, and you've got to be open to those things.
It's scary to ask people to live in the moment instead of planning ahead is very, again, it takes a lot of courage for you to say, you know what, I'm going to be present. I'm going to be on a podcast talking about mental health. I'm not an expert, but I am here. And that moment where you're here and you don't know how you're going to respond to something, to put yourself in that position can be scary. I think people will get used to it. I think as you get older, you care less and you kind of relax. Maybe I blame everything on age now. I'm getting better because I'm older. But the input output discussion is particularly interesting because I mean, my background is tech. I graduated in artificial intelligence when it was not a sexy topic. Actually, I couldn't get a job. No one liked artificial intelligence. It was only academics. But what you realize in AI is everything is input and output, and how decisions are made. Yes, huge amounts of input and output. I mean, you're looking at 40 years worth of experience that you're kind of managing your whatever's coming through your brain right now is going through 40 years of experience, and then it gets output into whatever you've got from that. And I'm not comparing you to a machine, but it is very basically that. There's a certain amount that you've got from being built as a human, and the fact that physically you have a brain and your synapses and everything else, but then how you fill it and how that comes through you, that's just experience.
I think that's the thing. We come on to sort of artificial intelligence, which I didn't know you were an expert in this, but that's fascinating. And it's a conversation we've had less so around artificial intelligence, but based around things like algorithms and about how we talked about, you know, if you have an opinion, the algorithm will find people with that opinion or the opposite so that you'll engage with them and the thing that always strikes me, and it's more about the art competition as much as anything, is that the computer system removes the what we call the free radicals, the thing which is completely different, the idea which comes from nowhere or nothing that a computer couldn't build or design, but a human with their perception of the wider world can suddenly go, well, actually, why don't we make those wheels round instead of square? I'm sure they'll move a lot smoother on the road. Why don't we build roads at the same time? That sort of free radical exists within the art world in a way that, and I know there are computers now that are creating art and we can what does this mean? But it's a very human, that's the difference in humans potentially. Although you'll tell me now that artificial intelligence has developed free radicalism.
That's a really long conversation. So I think I'll probably stick away from it. But there's definitely something to be said about, so for example, how we're built, a submissions platform and things coming in and how people are selected was particularly interesting to me, coming from a background where algorithms are everything. And actually the solution to that was to make sure that it was humans making the decisions. So all submissions go through the judges. The only control I have is potentially in the judges that I can secure and that I can bring to the competition, because it'll be taken through their minds and then they'll make their decisions based on that. But actually removing the machine from that decision is really important in this case. You talked about AI and the fact that it generates art. Of course it does. I used to be an extremist. I used to be AI at some point will just replace, we are replaceable. I've tamed that, and I actually don't believe in that anymore. I think that half of the art is what it's made of, and half of the art is the story behind it. And as a person, if I make art, and as a computer, if a computer makes art, I ask the story about the computer. It's like, well, it's a computer. And it's like, okay, great. That's a great story once. Yes, a computer has made an incredible artwork. But if a computer continues creating artwork, then the story is flat. There's nothing there. But as a person, what happens is you see the art and you perceive the person, and then you have the story of the person on top of it. Van Gogh, his ear, all these little things that add value to the art is the human story. It's that empathy with someone else. Am I going to empathize with a bit of silicon? No. I think that they had this amazing survey saying which are the careers least capable of being replaced by machines. And they said it was pastors and people who were doing preaching, because obviously you don't want a machine to tell you about God and the afterlife. So it is about that human story, that experience. And I think AI will actually be beneficial in allowing people to express themselves in different ways. It'll be a tool. It's like anything else. We created pens. No one felt like pens are going to replace humanity. AI is a tool. We need to use it as a tool. And yes, if you go 50 years up the line and you're thinking Blade Runner and empathetic robots and machines, I think the biggest question will be more about, are we just creating another form of slave labor? Should they be recognized as, if they start empathizing and start being real, is it just kind of a human in a different material? And all these questions could take you in any location. Absolutely. Mix. So I'm not going to do that.
You were right. Well, that was far too open a question, but you've given us a fantastic answer there. It was that server that you saw with the pastors that, you know, you couldn't replace them because of the way they interacted. Also, I think also on the list was gardeners, because they were saying that you can send out a little robot lawnmower to mow your lawn, but and you can plan a garden using AI and a computer could do it. But that gardener who judges how a plant looks in a certain light or how two plants sit together next to each other, you can't do that from every angle in every garden through a role. It's just impossible. But as a human being, your natural intuition is, do those two plants work together? Do I feel comfortable sitting in this place, looking over at this plant, or would I rather be sitting over here looking towards the garden shed? You can make those decisions as a human, which you can't make as a robot. And yet, if you said now on a list of the hierarchy of great jobs or important jobs, where is a gardener? Probably quite low down. But actually, this idea that it's almost a future-proof job makes it, I think, more valuable.
There is merit in seeing technology as an optimistic, progressive way of looking at the world. I mean, about, I think, probably 70 years ago, probably more actually, 100 years ago, I don't know when bowling was invented, but bowling was invented. And what they did is they had little kids at the back putting the everything back up every time someone would bowl. That's not a job. I mean, if you can replace that, which we did with automation, if we can replace things that are removing us from the best things of being a human being and actually allowing us to unlock our potential in other fields and that creativity, the gardening. You had an amazing guest that talked about hairdressing and how people opened up to him. It's not about the haircut. It's not the machine cutting the hair. Also, whether or not you like a machine welding something that's sharp around your face.
The robo barber, yeah.
But it's that human connection. It's what makes us what we are. And that will always be built in all of us. What I thought was particularly interesting is I gave a talk about AI. And at the end of the talk, someone approached me. He said, really interesting. Would you like to be hypnotized? Would you like to understand how your own mind works? And kind of get a deeper understanding of it. And he did. We organized a date. He hypnotized me, and it kind of took me on a journey of, well, I know how to build a machine that has algorithms that think, but how do I actually work? How does this process things? And that moment of hypnosis was fascinating. I mean, I don't know what people think about it, but he really took me under. And within a half hour session, I went from utter happiness to total despair, and he recorded it, and it went from tears to smiles to, and he said, these are the things that I brought up. Maybe this is something that you might want to look into. I also did neuro-linguistic programming because I thought that'd be quite interesting. So neuro-linguistic programming is just where we start hacking your own mind. So you think of a positive thing, you make a movement, and you kind of anchor that movement to a positive thing. And then eventually, if you make that movement, it gives you happiness. It's a strange way of kind of reversing a thought into a physical action, that creates a thought. Probably a bit complicated again for the end of this conversation, but just knowing how your mind works is really interesting. And it will be different for everyone, but having an understanding that you have this black box on top of your shoulders, and you only really see how it reacts when an input comes in and how you output. There's moments where you think you've got control and something comes in and you have no idea why your reaction was in a particular way. And that happens a lot with little kids. I'm sure that you've got that, where you react and you're like, why did I react that way? This was completely wrong. And it came out of nowhere. And just looking back at that and thinking about where that reaction came from is really interesting too.
Absolutely.
I'm babbing, sorry.
No, not at all. And it brings us full circle, doesn't it, to that thing of know your own brain, you know how you work and how you respond first, because that then allows you to be more empathetic or effective in the way that you sort of treat future tasks within a work environment, or how you interact with someone in a conversation. It's an absolutely fascinating conversation. We touched on so many things in that, didn't we? That was a varied ship that we sailed on this week's edition of Mental Health Monday. Let's point people in the direction of the competition. I've got a closing date on this one for the 11th of July of this year, 2022. And you're supporting Create, a great organization as well, through that competition. I will put a link to the Amplify competition on the bottom of the podcast, and you can get involved in that. Guy Armitage, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for joining us on Mental Health Monday.
Thank you for the honor. Take care.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.